over the middle of last week and had said that he and Mary were finally going to get to his work, was going to let him go on vacation. So he asked if I would teach, and I said, sure. We did not get to discuss the collection, so that's what we're going to do. Let's go back up a little bit. Oh. Okay. I don't know, I get so used to just getting in a certain spot. Okay, we're going to talk about the collection. We oftentimes, I think our just general tendency is the way we've ordered our service is that we chose to put the collection after the Lord's table, and oftentimes, I don't know, in my mind, it feels like, oh, I spent 20 minutes talking on the collection, on the Lord's table, and well, let's get the collection done so we can get on to the lesson. We maybe don't spend as much time thinking about collection as we ought to. Well, let me just first begin by asking this question: what's the purpose of the collection?
To support the work of the church, basically.
Okay. I think you're certainly right.
Idea implied too. I mean, it's understood that the church will have needs, but we have collections. So, like Paul says in 1 Corinthians 16, that we don't have to, rush together at times when a need comes up. So that, like he says, there's no gatherings when it comes.
Okay, the idea of preparation—that we're prepared in advance for when the church has needs. That's 1 Corinthians chapter 16. That certainly is one of the purposes. What else? What are the other purposes of the collection?
Just to help.
Okay, it is. That's right. It is for the needy saints.
Don't you think a latent purpose would be us to be in the habit of giving, and not just the habit, but the attitude of giving?
Yeah, it helps us. It helps us with our perspective, doesn't it? To one, be in the mindset of giving. Jesus said it's more blessed to give than receive. But then also, beyond that, I think it also helps us keep the right perspective of money, too, doesn't it? Remember what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moss and rust destroys, where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moss nor rust destroy. Where thieves do not break in and steal, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Not so much that us giving money is in some way us buying our way into heaven, but it does help us get money in the right perspective. All right, so what other purposes are of the collection are there? There's more.
It's from my store in heaven. God keeps an account in heaven.
Okay.
I don't know.
I think, I'm trying to think of which passage this is that we'll look at to talk about that. Let's look at 1 Timothy chapter 6. Maybe this is maybe the best passage to look at for that. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 17 through 19, Paul writes, "Command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty or trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Let them do good, that they may be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, they may lay hold on the eternal life." That last verse, verse 19, may be what you're speaking of there. But I think there's some spiritual blessings that come from giving. Giving is an offering to God. Now, maybe that's sort of what I was digging for and didn't get. But in Philippians, the fourth chapter, why don't somebody turn to Philippians 4 and read 15 through 19, and then someone else go to Hebrews 13 and 16. Philippians 4, 15 through 19 first.
"Moreover, as you Philippians know, in the early days of your acquaintance with the gospel, when I set out for Macedonia, not one church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving except you only. For even when I was in Thessalonica, you sent me aid again and again when I was in need.
Let's see, go through 19.
Okay. Not that I am looking for a gift, but I am looking for what may be credited to your account. I have received full payment and even more. I am amply supplied now that I have received from Epaphroditus the gifts you sent. They are a fragrant offering, an acceptable sacrifice pleasing to God. And my God will meet all your needs according to his glorious riches in Christ Jesus.
Isn't this interesting? Look at verses 17 and verse 18 there. Paul says that I seek the gift. He doesn't seek the gift, but what does he seek? He seeks the fruit that abounds to your account. Well, what does he mean by that? Well, I think verse 18 tells us that it is a sweet-smelling aroma, an acceptable sacrifice. See, our gift of money to God through the collection, it's not only for preparation for a time of need. It's not only to help us keep a giving heart and have money in the right perspective, but it also is, in a lot of ways, an offering to God. Now, let me ask you this. If we give abundantly to God, should we expect physical blessings in return?
I think so.
It's such a tricky topic, isn't it? Because we certainly don't want to have the attitude, well, I'm going to give God $5 because I'm going to turn this $5 into $50. But yet there is something to this. Mike, why don't you go to 2 Corinthians 9, verses 6 through 8.
I'll just make a comment on what you said, too. And one of the reasons that I say that is, you know, Jesus said it's more blessed to give than to receive. One of the reasons, I think, for that is if you are a person who gives, people naturally want to reciprocate. Good people do. And if you learn that by giving you're made better, then your life is going to be better, both physically and in the church.
Okay.
Is that not 2 Corinthians 9, 1?
6 through 8.
But this I say, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. So let each one give as he purposes in his heart, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound towards you, that you, always having all sufficiency in all things, may have an abundance for every good work.
All right, now, sometimes we just read verses 7 and 8, but look at what verse 6 is about. Verse 6 we sometimes read for other purposes, but notice that they're all connected together. That if you sow sparingly, you're going to reap sparingly. If you sow bountifully, you'll reap bountifully. And then, what is Paul to do? He immediately goes into talking about the collection. And so I think there is something there. I think we have to be careful. We don't want to preach a gospel of if you give a whole lot, you're going to get a whole lot. That's not the message here. Because notice what it says there at the end of verse 8. Why would God be giving you a lot in return? Well, so that you have an abundance for every good work. The implication there is that to whom much is given, much is required. All right, any other comments on the purpose of the collection? Well, I want to ask another very interesting question as we continue this topic. Is the collection a tithe? Should we be giving 10%?
That's not the way it's worded. It's okay to give 10%, but it may be good to give more.
Okay. Well, what was the tithe?
The tithe was a tenth of
it. It was a tenth. What was the purpose of the tithe, though?
To support the priest.
Absolutely. The priest, and we know, and not just the priest, but the whole tribe of Levi, really. The Levites, we know, they didn't have a possession. They had a few cities that were given to them, but they didn't have a possession. And so the tithe was a means by which it helped support the Levites and the priesthood. Was the tithe just money? Was it just a 10% of your money?
No, it wasn't 10% of your cull, even, like your livestock. You didn't take that 10% of the worst livestock you had. It had to be the very best.
That's right. And in the end, it really wasn't 10%. It was that. It was
they get 10% of everything a couple times a year.
Yeah. We say 10%, but it ends up being actually a lot more than that. And I don't want to spend the time looking at those passages. I think it ends up being like 20 to 30%. But the point that Tad's making is the most important point. It's of everything. It's of your livestock. It's of, remember, Jesus talks about how the Pharisees they tithe of these spices. They gave 10% of everything. And so the tithe was a payment in lots of ways to the Levites. And it helped support the Levites. And so the collection is not a tithe. And I think we have to be very specific about that. Now, we're commanded. How are we commanded to give? All right, willingly and as we purpose in our heart. They're almost the same thing. 2 Corinthians 9 and 7 passage that Mike just read. So let each give as he purposes in his heart, not grudgingly or out of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver. This is really contradictory to the way the tithe was. The tithe was grudgingly and of necessity. It was required of the church, of the children of Israel, to give 10%. And we know that not all giving under the law was a tithe. In Deuteronomy 16, verse 17, this is, I think, what maybe part of what Tad was referencing. Deuteronomy 16 and 17, this was during the Feast of the Tabernacle. We read, "Every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessing of the Lord your God, which he has given thee." So even under the Old Testament, there was this idea that you give as you've been give as you're able. Now, certainly, we could use the tithe as a measuring stick. I think that would be an appropriate measuring stick, because we can look in the book of Malachi, and in Malachi chapter 3, verse 8, God says that if you don't give a tithe, you're robbing him, which this is written under the old law, so take it for that. I don't know how to make a real application of the new covenant, but here in Malachi 3 and 8 it says, "Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, in what way have we robbed you? In tithes and offerings." So apparently God looks at giving less than 10% as robbery. So let's get to the real important question here. How much should we give?
Well, it's a hard issue.
It is.
An individual heart issue, then we have to, we know, and no one else knows. God knows.
Yeah.
How much, and there's time. It doesn't have to be a set amount that we give all the time. It can vary as your prosperity varies. As you have you may have a job where you just have income that comes in when you finish a job, and that may, or you sell your cattle or you do different things,
Let's talk about that for just a minute. I think you're right, but I think that we can't take the next assumption, okay? I think it's good for us to look at what we have earned and use that as a means by which to determine how much to give. But I think it's pretty dangerous if we say, "I haven't earned anything, and therefore I'm not going to give anything." Those two things, one is not a natural conclusion of the other. Okay, just because you prosper and then you adjust your give according to you prosper doesn't mean that if you didn't make any money this week or this month or this year that you shouldn't give. And let's look at a couple of examples of that. Let's look at 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 12. Someone read this for me. 2 Corinthians 8 and 12.
"For if there is first a willing mind, it is accepted according to what one has, not according to what he does not have."
All right, now, this is not talking about the collection, but I think we have a general principle here, that the idea is it's acceptable according to what you have, not what you don't have. So if we base our contribution on what we don't have, "I didn't make any money this week," I think we have the wrong attitude. We're supposed to base it on what we have. We're supposed to do what's acceptable according to what we have. And really the best example of this is what we see in Luke chapter 21 with the widow and her two mites. It's entirely possible that that's all the woman had, and hadn't earned it that week. I mean, we know that that's all she had. She only had those two mites, and yet she gave them anyway. And it, in verse 4, it says, "And all of these out of their abundance have put into offerings for God, but she, out of her poverty, put in all the livelihood that she had." So I guess I just want to point out, we need to be careful to say that, yes, if we make more money, we ought to be giving more to God. But if we have no income, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't give. We ought to give of what we have.
But if we have no money,
we
don't have to give.
Well, now that is true. Yeah, we have no money, which...
That's what that verse is saying.
Yeah, there is some implication there.
I don't remember if it was Elijah or Elisha, but remember the woman who had the son, and she had enough meal to make one more cake of bread, and then they were going to die.
Yeah.
And he says, "No, I want you to make that for me." And she did that. And because she did that, she never ran out of food.
Yeah. There is an element here of, do you trust in God or do you not? Of course, there in Proverbs, is it Proverbs 30? We're told to pray that we not be too rich and not trust in God, or too poor that we steal. So I hope none of us find ourselves in that circumstance.
I think you're right. I mean, I agree with you that we should, every week we should give something. I mean, if it's a penny.
Yeah.
We should give. It's just that act of giving is very important.
Yeah, the widow, she gave all she had. What is the logic in that? I mean, the widow would need support, so now is the church going to have support? I just don't know. I mean,
Let's look at a very similar situation. How did the first century church give? Not just the first century church, but the church in Jerusalem. Let's look at this, because this is an interesting dilemma. In Acts chapter 2, this is after the church has started, verse 44 and 45. "Now all who believed were together and had all things in common, and sold their possessions and goods and divided them among all as anyone had need." Now, I don't know that we can go so far as to say that the church in Jerusalem, the members who lived in Jerusalem, sold everything. But they certainly sold a lot. It doesn't say they sold all of their possessions, but they did sell possessions. And then we skip over to Acts chapter 4, verses 32 through 35. "Now the multitude of those who believed were of one heart and one soul. Neither did anyone say that any of the things he possessed was his own, but they had all things in common. And with great power the apostles gave witness of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon all them all. Nor was there anyone among them who lacked, for all who were possessors of land or houses sold them, and brought the proceeds of the things that were sold, and laid them at the apostles' feet, and they distributed to each as anyone had need." We get the picture that the church here... Remember, when the church was started, that it was at the time of the Passover, all these Jews had traveled into Jerusalem. They had no intentions of staying as long as they did, and yet they did stay. And so those who were local, they appeared to have sold what they had, maybe not all of what they had, but a good portion of what they had, so that they could take care of everyone else. And so while these acts of charity and kindness appear to be an ideal situation, what happened in Jerusalem after this? What do we read of in the whole rest of the New Testament? The persecution comes, the church scatters abroad, there certainly are some, including the apostles, who stay in Jerusalem. And what happens to the church in Jerusalem?
Wasn't there a drought?
Not just that, but they were just poor. The church in Jerusalem, when we look at history, when we look at the scriptures, they were poor. Once everyone had sold everything and all the resources had depleted, the church didn't have any wealth, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But the church of Jerusalem fell into some severe times of poverty. Scholars are in wide agreement that at least sections of the Jewish church in the first century experienced chronic poverty, that they just could not get out of poverty. In Romans, the 15th chapter, the 26th verse, it says, "For it pleased those from Macedonia and Achaia to make certain contributions for the poor among the saints who are in Jerusalem." So yes, there was a drought that afflicted Israel, but yet even beyond that, we see that the church in Jerusalem was just a poor church. Now, this poverty prompted the leaders of the church in Jerusalem to instruct Paul to remember the poor during his ministry. Galatians chapter 2, verses 9 and 10, "And when James, Cephas, and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that had been given to me, they gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship, that we should go to the Gentiles, and they to the circumcised. They desire only that we should remember the poor, and the very thing which I also was eager to do." So we have this, we get this picture that the church at Jerusalem, because they gave so much, they gave to the brink of poverty, and even some of them were chronically poor, that the rest of the church in Macedonia, Achaia, they had to make contributions to help the church in Jerusalem. So I guess the thing that I want to say about this is, take it with a grain of salt. Don't give so much that you're poor, so that you have to rely on the church to take care of you. That's not what the Lord wants. The Lord wants you to provide for your own, but yet in doing so, He also wants you to give to Him. Dwayne.
I look at this as being in God's plan that the church at Jerusalem that indicates the old law, basically that. They spent, and they were very poor, but this was a bonding thing then for the Gentiles then to start sending in.
Yeah.
You see, that was tying back in, and it was kind of breaking down that middle wall. Not helping to do that.
Right, think about it. Yeah, and you're right. There's other things there, too. But, you know, the church in Jerusalem was going to be probably entirely Jews, and the Jews were so proud of themselves. And wouldn't that help break them down to understand that these are my Christian brothers and sisters, even though they're Gentiles, and I need them to help me? Yeah. Eddie?
Remember, the Galatians, remember that their parents were giving everything they had to the church, and they were neglecting them as far as taking care of them.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, the Pharisees were doing this. Yeah, they. Yeah, we ought to be careful. We don't want to use our contribution as an excuse for neglecting our family. I think that's really what you're getting at, isn't it? And that's what the Pharisees were doing. Well, I can't take care of you in your old age because I gave what I was supposed to take care of you with to the church. So, fend for yourself, Larry.
I think it's interesting too that we find. At times, the church in Jerusalem is setting up suggestions and the way they're to live. They are the ones in poverty needing help. So, being a poor church doesn't mean anything about your influence.
Oh, right, yeah.
I mean, they were still the leaders, and they were setting, when they talked about what they would eat.
Yeah. When the Gentiles came in, where'd they go?
Yeah.
I think they probably went there because that's where the apostles were. And at least three of the apostles at this point in time, when Paul and Barnabas came, at least three of them were still there.
The statement you made, I think, is right about when they sold lands and possessions, they weren't required, I don't think they were required to sell it, and if they did sell it, they weren't required to give it all, because that's what, when Ananias and Sapphira lied about it, Peter says, after you sold it, it was still your money. You didn't have to give it all. Your problem was you said you did, and you lied about it.
Yeah.
So they didn't have to, they weren't forced to sell, they weren't forced to give, they did it because they wanted to.
Yeah, and you know, the situation with Ananias and Sapphira kind of leads us really into our next topic. You know, the Jews were used to this arrangement where there was some box, a container of some sort that was in the temple that you could go and give your money to the temple. And it was sort of a big public to-do thing. Hey, here's my money. Everybody watch, see how much I'm giving. And so Ananias and Sapphira, it could be that I think, in my mind, I get the picture that something very similar was happening to the church when it was giving in the after it was first started, that everyone knew that Barnabas had this piece of property and he sold it and he gave all of it to the church. So Ananias and Sapphira, they're tempted with pride in a lot of ways. And so, you know, I have no idea if any of you have sold possessions and contributed that to the church. It just doesn't work that way anymore. And partly because that process, that system, promotes pride and it promotes, well, you know, Dwayne has a lot of money and he contributes a lot to the church. We ought to ask his opinion on how we do things. You know, the money and influence that we see today in our political system that could easily creep into the church. And so the process that we have is not the same as what we see in Jerusalem, not what we see under the old law. So what is the process? How should we collect money? Well, the truth of the matter is they're really given no example. There's no thou shalt pass the plate, right? There's none of that. There's no put money on the back of the wall or in the box. You know, just we're not told how to collect, what the process by which we're to collect. We do know that it was a gift of money. So if you're thinking about willing something to the church, that's probably not something that we see in the scriptures. We don't see Barnabas give his land to the church. He sells the land and then gives the money to the church. So the church doesn't need possessions. It needs the money. That you understand what I'm saying? In the tithe, they gave things. Now, that was the system. That was the monetary system. They did a lot of bartering. But now we give money. We don't give things to the church. So we know that at least the process of collection is a collection of money, not of things. We do know that it is on the first day of the week. 1 Corinthians chapter 16 says, "Now concerning the collection for the saints, I have given orders to the churches of Galatia. So you must do also on the first day of the week. Let each one of you lay something aside, storing up as he may prosper, that there be no collections when I come." Now, Dwayne commented on this. Dwayne, I'm going to take it the next step further. I think it is a requirement. It's a command for us to give every week. Maybe I know there's a lot of school teachers. Emily was a school teacher. You only get paid once a month. I think there is something here to giving once a week, as opposed to just, I get paid once a month, so I'm going to give once a month. But I think there's something there. So we know we're supposed to give weekly. But we do see in some congregations this issue of special collections. The process being something like, whatever the normal process is, we pass plates. Emily and I have been at places where this has happened. They'll pass a plate, and then either somebody goes and counts the money and says, "We didn't get enough," or someone gives a little spiel and says, "We've got this special project and we'd like you to give to it." So the typical collection is done, and then there's some plea for additional funds. For whether some special project or we didn't get enough money. What's the problems with this? Do you not see an issue with it? Is this something that we ought to do or not to do?
I see a problem with it because you're supposed to give that you didn't prosper the first time. So why would you then turn around and give again? I mean, you should have already given what you could and what you can cheerfully give and whatever. And to do it again.
And what happens with that second collection? Doesn't the mentality change? Now how are you giving? You're not giving cheerfully. You're not giving out of a willing heart. You're giving out of grudge and necessity, aren't you? And so it's almost like, hey, we're going to kind of guilt you into giving more. And I think that in and of itself is a reason to not do it. Mike?
And I think if you talk about special projects or whatever, the same rule applies to when you give, you don't say, "I'm giving this money and I want it earmarked for this purpose." Okay? If we don't have enough faith in the deacons and the elders to use the money of the church properly, then we got a bigger problem. We see no example in the scriptures that, you know, that we give and say, this is my money. Well, is it really? It's God's money. And this is what I want to use for, you know. Also, I want to make another comment too. You said, you know, we only, about only giving money. It might be, you know, it might be that a person owns a piece of land and you might need to build a new church building. And you might not be able to build it where you're at, or you might be starting a new church. Maybe you might give that land for a building to be built on. You know, there might be instances where we can give other than money.
Okay.
But the example is of giving money on first day of every week.
Okay. You're probably right.
Back in my days, back in the old days.
That was probably the way the church
got paid. A lot of times the preacher was paid by designation, you know, and that wasn't put in the collection plate. A member that had lots of chickens would bring some eggs or some canned goods, you know, to give to the preacher.
I guess the idea that I'm thinking is that, well,
if you're thinking about it on the first day.
Yeah. I think there is a difference between sharing what we have and giving to God. I want to get back to this issue of the special collections, because James and I brought up the first point, and that is when you have a special collection, you change change the hearts of the people, because now you're giving out of necessity. It's a guilt give. And then the second issue is what Mike brings up, and that is that you change the process of decision making. Just think about it. Instead of having a single treasury where the church as a whole collectively decides how to accomplish God's work, you now have multiple collections where individuals are deciding whether to fund a project or not. And so the popular activities that are easiest to fund, they get money. And then the stuff that maybe really is the most needed thing doesn't happen. Maybe I'm a wealthy Christian, but I'm not very strong in the faith, and so I choose to give my money to, I don't know, say, you know, build a nice fountain out front. That's great, it's pretty, but maybe had I given that money to take care of evangelistic work, maybe the deacons or elders felt like that's really not necessary. It'd be better to support this person. Or maybe there's a situation that they're aware of where an individual in the church has a need that could be taken care of, and it wouldn't be as needed for some physical thing. So you change the decision making process. James, you had a comment.
Well, I was also going to say, if I know there's going to be three or four or five or six collections, okay, how much am I going to give in that first collection? And the second collection,
yeah.
The third. I mean, I'm probably going to wind up, if I know that there are multiple collections, I'm probably going to wind up giving the same amount I would originally.
Yeah.
And but like you said, then I'm choosing which activity I want to support.
Yeah. There's a I don't know if everybody's has been a part of an organization that does this kind of thing. Not really a religious organization, but maybe some professional group or some social club where it's just sort of this known thing. They're going to collect some money, and then they're going to put some pressure on you to collect more money. What happens? That thing happens right there. I'll give $5 because I know they're going to ask for me for more later. And I want to save face. Tad.
I was just thinking there's two things on this subject. The passage there in 1 Corinthians 13 definitely agrees with what you're saying, that we should never be in a situation where we have to call another gathering to bring money together. And that's why they have collections, so you don't need additional gatherings. At the same time, though, I definitely agree that having multiple collections would make things more complicated, but I also don't think that we can completely label it as inappropriate at any time. Because I think there's situations where we would do it and no one would have a problem with it. You know, what if we get a letter from the church saying that, you know, there's an evangelist that they're not going to be able to support completely? for a given month or something. And I don't think anyone here would probably have a problem if we said, hey, if you have some extra money, we need to send a gift to this evangelist. And, you know, ideally we would be able to do that from the church's existing funds, but I don't think anyone would resist that if we needed to pick up a special collection to support their work.
I think it would depend a lot on how... It would depend a lot on how it's approached.
Well, we're doing that right now. Not about evangelists, but we're collecting money right now for food for the meeting, which is separate from what we give on the first day of the week. So, you know.
I know what you're saying. I guess some of it has to do with, it comes back to really what you purpose in your heart. It, in my mind, and not knowing how others handle this, I'm a little hesitant to talk about this. But in my mind, you know, we know that we've made a decision. We're not gonna purchase food for meeting out of the money that people contribute to the work of the church. But yet we did. You know, we just had a meeting. We got a lot of people in, and we needed to be. And so I don't have any issues with us collectively giving money for that. But I don't, if I'm giving money to that, man, in my mind, that we have an amount that Emily and I give, and then whatever we choose to contribute to the food is in addition to that. And I don't know that I view that as a special collection, because in the end, if none of us gave, I'm certain that the folks who did buy the food would, you know, they've already bought it, and it's a done deal. They're not going to come begging to the church and say, hey, nobody contributed.
Of course, that's sort of a giving, too.
Yeah, it is.
A form of giving.
But there's an individual responsibility there.
Yeah.
Okay. And in some cases, that's individuals make up the church, but we also have individual responsibility giving out to things outside of the church also.
Yeah. You know what, maybe this goes back to the thing that Eddie was saying about the Pharisees saying, well, I gave my money to the church, I don't have to do anything else. Maybe that's really the attitude we need to avoid here. We have an amount that we give each first day of the week, and as other needs come up, you know, if we view that as a special collection, like Kat's mentioning, then, you know, we can't make such a broad statement that we can't make special collections. I guess I just don't see that as a special collection. It's just a need that comes up.
I think it'd be better off to simply, I mean, you can announce something like that, okay, that, you know,
yeah.
We would like to be able to support so and so, you know, for this period of time. One of the other churches is having trouble, you know, meeting this need, and so, you know, if we can, you know, there's nothing wrong with you know, making that part of the announcements. I don't know that you'd really need to do a special collection just for that.
I guess I should just be clear with what I know I don't like, what I don't think is scriptural. The idea of, while we're all assembled together, someone putting a guilt trip on you to give more money. That's the issue that I think we see a lot of times happen in religious organizations, and it's not something, it changes the nature. If whatever we do, if we change the nature of how people are to give, if we now make them give out of guilt or necessity, then we're asking them to do something that the scripture doesn't do. I need to ask a question. When am I supposed to be done?
A quarter after.
A quarter after. Okay. I couldn't remember.
Yeah.
I want to come to another question here. Who is to give? Well, most certainly Christians are to give. In 1 Corinthians 16, it's very clear that it's Christians are to be given. Is there any obligation for non-Christians to give?
No.
And if we want to make a point of that, that's fine. But there is no obligation for anyone outside of the church to give. But can we accept money from non-Christians?
Certainly not for a specific purpose. Nope.
Yeah.
And okay. We've had people want to do that in the past. They want to give money, say, for someone who has died. In memory of that person, we want to give money for you to do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's no more scriptural than for me or you to say, here's my money and I want this done.
Well, let's just assume that everything is happening in the appropriate way. If I'm a non-Christian and I want to give money to the church, can the church accept that money? Sure it can, right? We see a couple of examples of that. In Acts, the 10th chapter, the first two verses talks about Cornelius. And notice what it says about Cornelius. There was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian regiment, a devout man, one who feared God with all his household, who gave alms generously to the people and prayed to God always. Now, we get the picture here that Cornelius gave alms, this idea of giving some of his money away. Now, does it specifically say that he gave money to the Jews? No, not exactly. He wasn't a Jew, but he did, in fact, aid the Jews, and God took note of it. There's another centurion in Luke chapter 7, verses 2 through 5, and a certain centurion servant who was dear to him was sick and ready to die, so that when he heard about Jesus, he sent elders of the Jews to him, pleading with him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they begged him earnestly, saying that one for whom he should do this was deserving, for he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue. So here's this idea of a non-Jew doing something for the Jews. He built them a synagogue. So in both cases, we don't see the generosity being condemned because of the source, because they weren't Jews. So how do we translate this into the New Testament? I'm not entirely sure. I think that if a person's motives are pure and they want to just give money to the church, we certainly could accept it. Now, what Mike is mentioning is an interesting dilemma, and that is sometimes people give money with strings attached. So I'll just ask this question. Can we accept money from our government?
I don't think it's a dilemma at all.
Well, no, it's not a dilemma, but it changes things. Can we accept money from our government? Well, probably we can. But what happens, right? That's right. Well, for example, we're a not-for-profit. I don't think there's any reason why we can't be a not-for-profit organization. If the laws of the land allow us to not pay taxes, that's more money we can use for God's purposes. If the laws of the land said we had to pay taxes, we ought to pay taxes. But our laws allow us to be not-for-profit, so we can be not-for-profit. Because of our not-for-profit status, we're eligible for certain government monies, aren't we? So could we petition the government for money?
Yeah, but you got to be subject to all the rules, and one of them just went into effect the first day of August.
Well,
providing abortion, contraceptives, et cetera, et cetera. If you're going to take money from the government, you're beholden to it.
So there's two issues here, and this is maybe this is in my mind, if I think this would ever come up. First and foremost, petitioning the government for money is not collection, is it? God specifies how we're to collect money, and that process is something entirely different. And so it's really outside of the realms of how the church is to collect money. But yet if for whatever reason, say, you know, we just had a tornado go through Joplin, the government, I don't know if this happened, but the government could approach churches and say, we'd like to give you some funds to help the community. Could we accept that? Well, probably not, because most of the time there's strings attached. And those strings attached are the things that keep us from accepting money from outside sources. I want you to think about a couple of things. We're going to finish now. And I think Clayton's going to be back from vacation next week, and so he'll start. But as the kids are coming up, how can money for the church be used? Well, we're told only a few things specifically. Now, I don't think this is an all-inclusive list. Well, we're told that it's for the saints. It could be used for needy saints, whether it's the case of poverty or physical needs. We see all of these mentioned in scriptures: care for widows, pay for elders, pay for evangelists. Those are the four or five items that we have that we can be absolutely certain that we can use the church money for. Beyond that, then it starts to be a matter of discussion. And there are a number of things that we as a group have made decisions on, and we have to make decisions on. Things like what we just talked about. Whether or not we're going to pay for food for a meal. Those are things that the scriptures don't really talk about, but we have to make decisions on. So, we're out of time, but something for you to consider. How does the church use its money? Those four things we can be certain of. I don't think anyone would disagree.
Yeah, and I want to get us back where we started.
Yeah.
This giving is an individual thing, and of the heart, and we've kind of complicated it by talking about a whole lot of things, and we've got to really be careful about making rules and laws that the scripture doesn't specifically make, because we can get into all kinds of situations, but...
Yeah.
We don't want to. What you said was so true. We don't want to do things that will change the person's heart. I mean, pressure them, to do that, because that kind of a gift is not. God doesn't. It doesn't count anything.
Yeah, it's not really.
If you make people give,
Yeah.
So we just got to remember, it's an individual thing that each one of us have to answer to God how we determine how much to give. And even when we give, as far as giving extra gifts or things like that.
And it's so different than the way the world perceives
right.
it. If you were to go into some other group, there's an expectation. There's many groups that still require a tithe. You got to turn in your tax forms to prove, but it's a silly thing.
You got a budget.
Yeah, it's between you and God. And that really is very clear. Okay, we'll take a short break.